This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, Turkish troops roll into northern Syria. Kurdish fighters are in their sights. Civilians are said to be among the first casualties. The UN Human Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, tells me she fears the worst.
When a country makes a decision as important as this, should be aware of the consequences. Should be aware of the political consequences, but also the human rights consequences. And what we're seeing now is pretty disturbing.
The UN's top human rights official joins PM, also reflecting on how Australia has changed since she fled here from Chile in 1975. And we'll speak to Turkey's ambassador to Australia for his country's view of the action against the same Kurdish fighters who took on the Islamic State group. That's ahead on PM. But first tonight, police say that two people have died in the bushfires that ripped through the north of New South Wales this week. A 77-year-old man and a 68-year-old woman were killed in the Long Gully Road fire in the Drake area, police say. A number of residents are still missing in the region. The bushfires have destroyed at least 21 homes, mostly in the Rapville area. The bushfire is also believed to have burnt through one of the most important koala colonies on the north coast. Bronwyn Herbert reports.
It's the worst possible news for the bushfire-affected communities in northern New South Wales. Police have just confirmed an elderly couple have died in the Long Gully Road fire that ripped through the remote settlement of Coomba on the edge of State Forest. Superintendent Toby Lindsay.
And unfortunately, a short time ago, two human remains have been identified. To a wider extent, the families have certainly been apprised and close family liaison has occurred today. I can confirm a 77-year-old male and a 68-year-old female are believed to be the people that have died at this premise.
Ewingar resident Alan Highfield managed to save his property with the help of a neighbour and a quad bike that had a water tank.
I reckon the flames, the wall would have been 10 to 15 metres. And the plume would have been 30 metres. Just this incredible browny golden plume above it all, just racing down the hill towards the hall, and taking out houses on the way, obviously. It had jumped over the North Ewingar Road. Then it roared up here past the hall and jumped over the ridge road and straight on here.
Local wildlife have also been hurt.
Koala came running through, or toddling through as they do, and went across the road and jumped into a gum tree, and the next second the gum trees all around it were alight. And so I hate to think what happened to that poor little koala. We saw roos hopping down the road, and last night, just as it was getting dark, I think it was a red billy go across my feet trying to get away, you know. There's probably no hope for the scalies and the furries.
Key koala habitat has been burnt out in the Busby's Flat fire, which is still out of control and has burnt out more than 40,000 hectares. Several hundred koalas are believed to live in state forests around the Rapville area. Ros Irwin from Friends of the Koala says they won't be able to get in to rescue koalas until the fire is contained, and that could be weeks away.
I've spoken to the RFS and advised them that we stand ready. If they get any koalas that they have that have been affected by the fire, we'll go out and pick them up and we'll certainly bring them back.
Many Rapville residents are still at the evacuation centre or staying with friends until given the all clear to return home. Mayor Robert Musto is asking for patience.
Well, the challenges are the infrastructure to start with, and also like the safety concerns. The trees are on fire, they're still falling down. There's over 150 electricity poles, so naturally the wires are down. We don't want any more casualties or injuries, so I'd ask the people to be very patient.
The two major bushfires that this week merged have collectively burnt out more than 115,000 hectares. Although there is still active fire, crews and aircraft have slowed the spread of the blaze today, helped by much milder conditions, with rain predicted for the weekend.
Bronwyn Herbert with that report. Well, Turkey's president is calling his country's military incursion into northeastern Syria a peace spring. We'll hear shortly that that's not the view of the UN Human Rights Chief. Turkish troops have begun a land offensive against Kurdish militia fighters across that border just days after President Trump ordered US troops back from the area. A total of 181 militant targets have been hit with airstrikes and howitzers since the start of the operation. World leaders fear it could destabilise the region and see a resurgence of Islamic State. Nick Grimm reports.
The Trump administration denies it gave the green light for this bombardment, but Turkey wasted no time launching its military operation once US forces had been removed from Kurdish-controlled areas across its border. Explosions on the ground, warplanes in the skies overhead, and Kurds themselves fleeing towns and villages being targeted. This man says, "We saw two tanks in front of our village, so we left, fearing that our children might get hurt. Most people left, but some young men stayed behind." Turkey has been widely condemned for launching its military action, with Australia's Prime Minister himself sending that message in no uncertain terms.
Let's be clear, it's the Turkish government that is taking action here to create an unstable situation. They're the ones who are actually deploying and seeking to walk across a border and to take actions in another nation state. It is the Turkish government that's doing that, and it's the actions of the Turkish government that concern Australia very seriously.
But Scott Morrison is less concerned about Donald Trump's much criticised decision this week to withdraw US troops from Kurdish-occupied regions.
Well, I'm not making a running commentary on what the president says and does. What I do know is that when Australia makes decisions about our deployments, we do so in our national interest. And my concern and my focus is on what Australia's purposes are and the safety of our men and women who serve in our defence forces. And I would expect any of our partners or allies to respect any decision that I made and my government made in relation to our deployments. And I'm simply showing that same respect.
For its part, Turkey has tougher words for its friends in Washington. It's making no apologies for its incursion, insisting it's merely securing its borders against the threat of terrorism, after the United States failed to meet its expectations in that regard. That's the view, at least, expressed by Turkey's ambassador to the United Kingdom, Ümit Yalçın.
We made many deals with Americans, and also there were commitments by them to clean those areas and to create safe zones. And we did many negotiations, and we started some implementation of some commitments, but it didn't go anywhere. And these exercises turned into a kicking a can exercise. And then our patience ran out. And now we are determined to create a safe zone at our border for our national security.
Donald Trump acknowledging today that Turkey's plans were well known.
We've been talking to Turkey for 3 years. They've been wanting to do this for many years, as you know. They've been fighting each other for centuries.
The US president also had this for Kurds, who might feel abandoned by the United States.
They didn't help us in the Second World War. They didn't help us with Normandy, as an example. They mentioned names of different battles.
Setting aside the fact that the Kurds had no part in World War II's Normandy invasion, it's not the first time the US has walked away from an allegiance with the ethnic group, their quest for independence often proving an impossible ask for their sometime ally. Now, another superpower might move to exploit the shifting power balance and extend its influence. Americans have violated their promises many times, says Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, hinting he's already been talking to Kurdish leaders. They are extremely alarmed that such a lightweight treatment of this extremely delicate subject could ignite the entire region, he says.
Nick Grimm with that report. Well, Turkey's ambassador to Australia is Korhan Karakoç. He joined me a short time ago. Ambassador, thank you for your time today. Australia's Prime Minister has stressed he's concerned about the attacks on Kurdish forces today by Turkey. The opposition in Australia is in lockstep. How do you respond?
Well, I think such concerns are redundant, because this operation will only serve to the stability and peace of the region. Let me tell you why. Because the objectives of this operation are crystal clear to us. First of all, we will ensure our border security. We will neutralize the terrorist groups in the region. And in the middle term, we will facilitate safely and voluntary return of displaced Syrians in our country. And in the long run, we will contribute to the territorial integrity of Syria.
So why is it that so many very senior people, from the NATO Secretary General through to generals in the United States through to politicians around the country, are saying that this is a dangerous moment, that you could unleash ISIS all over again?
Well, it is a risky operation, that's for sure. But you know, we made it very clear to our allies about our expectations and sensitivities regarding the presence of PYD terrorist organization in our border area. And we repeatedly warned them and we brought to their attention that it's a huge mistake to fight with a terrorist organization with the help of another terrorist organization. Unfortunately, some of our allies opted to have this tactical engagement, and at this stage, you know, no one should expect Turkey to tolerate the presence of a terrorist organization operating actively in our border area.
And of course, when you say a terrorist organisation, the PYD, as you said, you're referring to the Kurds.
I meant PYD, which is the affiliated body of PKK. Yeah,
the Kurds. So,
I'm not referring to Kurds. I mean, this operation is not against Syrian Kurds. This operation is only against terrorist organisation.
But the group you're talking about is the Syrian Kurds, is it not? Those who were armed and...
It's the armed section, and these are the part of the Kurdish population, that is true. But let me remind you one thing. We are hosting almost 4 million Syrians in our territory, and 300,000 of them are, in fact, Kurds.
So would you not agree, as some have claimed, that this is Turkey pursuing its historic loathing of the Kurds across the Syrian border?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, this safe zone, I mean, it's a limited operation, first of all, and this safe zone will serve for the stability and peace of the local people up there, and we can also, I mean, the safe returns of some displaced Syrians from Turkey is very important for us, and that will enable us as well.
Do you accept, though, that the Kurdish forces in Syria were key to containing ISIS in the northeast of the country?
Well, I still believe that it was a huge mistake to somehow cooperate with a terrorist organization in order to fight another terrorist organization. But we were there. I mean, Turkey, as a NATO ally, was ready. And in fact, Turkey has been at the forefront of the struggle against Daesh. And therefore, I have to disagree with that assumption.
How do you then intend to ensure that ISIS is not unleashed again in Syria and indeed in Iraq, which is also very restive at the moment?
Believe me, the future of detained Daesh members is of paramount importance to us as well. All deconfliction channels are open and will remain open in order to prevent any incident that may harm the struggle against Daesh. And also, of course, a collective action is needed in the long run. We believe the most viable solution is the repatriation of Daesh members by their countries of origin. And for that end, I believe we will be ready to coordinate with our friends and allies.
And finally, Donald Trump has promised, in his infinite wisdom, those are his words, to wipe the Turkish economy, to wipe the Turkish economy off the map if it steps out of line against the Kurds. Do you fear economic consequences?
Well, not really, because the country is united behind this operation. I mean, the Turkish public opinion, the Turkish people, and we are famous with our resilience. And I believe that the operation in the middle term will bring some positive outcomes to the stability of the region, and all our friends and allies will be happy with, will be content with the outcome.
Ambassador Karakoç, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Turkey's ambassador to Australia, Korhan Karakoç. Well, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, says that what's unfolding in northeastern Syria is pretty disturbing, and she's called for restraint. Dr. Bachelet is visiting Australia. She joined me earlier in the PM studio. Michelle Bachelet, thank you so much for speaking with PM today. First, on the situation in northeastern Syria, critics fear a slaughter of the Kurds, an opportunity for ISIS. What are your concerns about the situation there?
Well, first of all, I'm really deeply disturbed by the ongoing military offensive in northeast Syria. And of course, very worried about the high risk of civilian casualties. We have already received reports that already emerging of civilians killed and injured. So on the other hand, we do understand as well that the Kurdish troops were the ones who were holding Daesh and ISIS and foreign fighters. So there is also a situation we don't know what was going to happen. If they evacuate some areas, what's going to happen with those camps? So I would say my main message would be to appeal to all sides to fully respect the international humanitarian law and to spare the long-suffering, repeatedly displaced civilians from further horrors.
President Trump has said that he wants to get out of what he calls these endless wars in the Middle East, wars which arguably have created the humanitarian and strategic nightmare that we've seen in the region. Is there merit in that argument, in the US removing itself altogether?
Of course, every country can make their own decisions on this regard, but I think that when a country makes a decision as important as this, should be aware of the consequences, should be aware of the political consequences, but also the human rights consequences. And what we're seeing now is pretty disturbing.
There is a lot of pressure on the international system at the moment in the midst of all these crises from countries like China and Russia, I guess Brazil under Bolsonaro as well, but also some from Australia. How do you respond to Prime Minister Morrison's comments at the UN General Assembly criticising negative globalism and an international bureaucracy?
I think there is a misunderstanding or a confusion here, because the United Nations is the 193 member states. I mean, the United Nations is not the bureaucracy. All the resolutions that come out of the General Assembly are resolutions approved, voted, and negotiated by member states. It's not us, not the Secretary General. And as a matter of fact, all the different international responsibility that Australia has taken for a long time are the ones that Australia have discussed, have been part of that. So I truly believe that the UN are the member states, and we are the ones who have to implement the decision of member states.
You also spoke last night about the public narrative around asylum policies being weaponized by misinformation and discriminatory attitudes. Is the Australian government a part of that weaponization in its language?
Well, I couldn't tell that. My main appeal has been permanently that I believe that hate speech is terrible. It can have awful consequences. And that was something we also spoke with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, because also women are targeted many times with hate speech, women politicians in particular. My call has been on all kinds of situations in all countries that leaders, and I'm talking about political leaders, but also social and business leaders, should raise their voice for positive, constructive values, against hate speech, against demonizing the person who is different because they're different.
And you mentioned climate, and I wanted to go briefly to that in the climate debate, whether you think Australia is being a good international citizen.
One of the main issues that is being pushing by the Australian government is to be able to support small island states to develop a resilient response to disasters, to all the consequences that we've seen on climate change. So I think that's very positive.
The criticism, of course, is that Australia is not doing enough on climate change itself, on carbon emissions. Has Australia fallen short on that, in your view?
Well, I think Australia can do more, and I hope it does more.
And just finally, I guess a wider sort of reflection. Australia is a country that gave you protection from the Pinochet regime in Chile in the 70s.
Yes.
When you look at Australia then and look at Australia now, do you see a country that is continuing to operate in the spirit of those days when you had to flee here?
To be honest, I think there's some differences. With me and my mum, when we came here, Gough Whitlam was the prime minister, and we were considered political refugees. And we had a wonderful welcome, and we have only words of gratitude to Australia. But it seems that now for migrants or refugees, it's not that easy. And I think it's important that we could think, as I mentioned last night, no country is obliged to accept every person who arrives at these borders, but we have the imperative of compassion. And I hope it will remain a country who welcomes people who are in need.
Michelle Bachelet, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Linda.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet. That's part of our conversation. We discuss more about migration and Australian policies on that, and Syria and justice for war crimes. That's at the PM webpage if you want to listen to the longer version. This is PM on radio, on the ABC Listen app and via the podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. Ahead, it's World Mental Health Day, so we're going to look at why 80% of people who go into business experience panic attacks and what can be done about it.
My co-founder and I, we had very young kids when we started the company, so we both struggled with sleep. The number one thing is it's irritability. You know, you don't get good sleep, so you're always set on this edge of having less patience and less time for people. And look, when you're a leader in the company, that impacts everyone.
Well, Michelle Bachelet's warning about hate speech was underlined in Germany overnight, where two people were shot dead on Yom Kippur, Judaism's holiest day. A heavily armed gunman tried to force his way into a synagogue in the German city of Halle before shooting two people dead on the street outside. Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel has called for action against anti-Semitic attacks as a result. It's the latest in a string of attacks on synagogues, and Jewish groups here in Australia are also calling for more action to protect all places of worship and condemn all forms of bigotry. Madeline Jenner reports.
In Berlin, German Chancellor Angela Merkel visited a synagogue to attend a vigil after a gunman who denounced Jews shot and killed two people in the city of Halle. It's been described as a terrorist attack, with the shooter firing at the door of a local synagogue where around 70 people were observing Yom Kippur. A 27-year-old has been arrested and the attack has been condemned by leaders across the world. But Vic Aladef, the CEO of the New South Wales Jewish Board of Deputies, says these attacks are becoming all too common.
Clearly, the terrorist here was out to murder as many Jewish people as possible simply because they are Jews. So it is absolutely to be condemned. And what is significant is that a massacre seemed to have been averted only because the synagogue had sophisticated security in place.
Vic Aladef says he is increasingly concerned about the rise in neo-Nazi parties across Europe. He was recently in Germany as a guest of the German Foreign Ministry.
We have seen the eruption onto the political scene of a new political party akin to a neo-Nazi party. It calls itself Alternative for Deutschland, and it has 92 seats in the federal parliament. So while the German government is very strong against anti-Semitism, outlaws the Nazi salute, etc., and takes many measures, it is extremely concerning not only in Germany but elsewhere in Europe. We have seen this eruption of neo-Nazi parties, extremist right-wing parties coming onto the political scene.
The shooter in Germany live-streamed his rampage on Amazon's gaming website, Twitch, and the nearly 36-minute-long video closely resembles footage live-streamed at the Christchurch attack, where a gunman also wore a camera as he killed 51 people at two mosques. Rabbi Zalman Castell is the National Director of Together for Humanity, which delivers multi-faith educational programs. He argues that we're seeing a change in public attitudes about faith and bigotry, which in turn is potentially leading to more attacks.
I think there's an overall increase in the social acceptability of bigotry, including anti-Semitism. Things that in the past people would be ashamed to say publicly are now being said quite proudly. I think there is a convergence of anger and populism, people feeling less well off and that things are bleak for them personally. And some politicians using intemperate language that dovetails with those kinds of feelings of grievance and resentment.
Julie Nathan is Research Director at the Executive Council of Australian Jewry. She produces the annual anti-Semitism report, which is focused on attacks in Australia, but she's also been watching developments closely overseas.
The major thing happening over the last year or so is the rise in an ideology called white replacement, which believes that people of European ethnicity are being replaced in countries of Europe, North America and Australia. And so this is why we are seeing a rise in shootings, for example, in Pittsburgh at the synagogue there last year, last October. At Christchurch, it's the same ideology.
For now, social media companies say they are doing all they can to scrub footage of the shooting from their platforms.
Madeline Jenner with that report. Well, it's probably an understatement to observe that starting a business from scratch is stressful, but evidence is emerging of a very high level of emotional distress among entrepreneurs. A new report coinciding with World Mental Health Day shows as many as 4 out of 5 new business owners are stressed to the point of needing psychological help. A hurdle to getting better, though, the experts say, is resistance to asking for help and whether that will hurt the owner's reputation and the business. Here is our business reporter, David Taylor.
Sibi Palakazeral is co-founder of Baraha. His team of engineers are developing laser technology they hope will make driverless cars a commercial reality on our roads.
It's basically a small device that will fire beams of light into the environment, reflect off an object and come back.
As the driverless cars concept made more headway, his business began to grow rapidly. But that busyness came at a particularly hectic time for his family, and his sleep started to suffer.
The number one thing is it's irritability. You know, you don't get good sleep, so you're always set on this edge of having less patience and less time for people. And look, when you're a leader in the company, that impacts everyone around you.
He knew something was wrong when he fell fast asleep during a simple meditation exercise.
And in all the exercises, I'd fall asleep in about 5 seconds. And then the trainer, Craig Davis, said, look, if you're falling asleep, that's already a sign that you're not where you need to be in terms of rest and recovery.
Amanda Price is head of high growth ventures or startups with the global consultancy firm KPMG, coaching and advising entrepreneurs. Her research reveals Sibi Palakazeral is one of an alarming and growing number of small business owners struggling to cope.
It's just incredibly stressful.
The KPMG study shows that 4 out of 5 startup founders weren't happy with their mental health and stress levels. Amanda Price says the sudden death nature of business failure is partly to blame, meaning a business wind-up can come quickly and without warning.
You know, we're actually just talking this morning about this, that have been doing reasonably well, but they've left, they, you know, then go to capital raise, they're not able to raise the capital, they're cash, they're burning cash. And that's that very unforgiving moment you spoke of. That's it, and it's done.
Jodie Lowinger is a clinical psychologist specialising in helping business owners to manage stress and anxiety. She puts much of this distress down to a primal fear among entrepreneurs that their very survival is at stake when business worries arise.
When we're establishing a business as an entrepreneur, there's an overwhelming amount of uncertainty and you're actually taking quite substantial risks putting yourself out there as an entrepreneur. And so that taps into our primitive survival instinct of the fight or flight reaction.
Part of the motivation for releasing the report, says KPMG's Amanda Price, is to shine a spotlight on the issue, reduce prejudice around it, and encourage more business owners to seek help.
There has been sort of persona that's built up around founders than being sort of the new rock stars of you know, the sort of business world. And I think that that's really incorrect, and it's put a lot of pressure on them. And so I think they feel sort of scared to speak out.
And entrepreneur Sibi Polakazerol has this advice for other business owners.
That's right. And the earlier you get into that when you're an entrepreneur, I think then the better tools you have for when things get past your level of comfort, that you, so you're able to rise to meet those challenges.
Business owner Sibi Polakazerol. David Taylor with that report. And that's PM for this Thursday. I'm Linda Mottram. Thank you very much for listening. We're on the ABC Listen app. You can subscribe to the PM podcast, and we're on free-to-air TV channel 26. And find all our audio at the webpage as well. Search ABC PM. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow. But now on RN, Michael Yanda is here with the money on why we pay what we do for our homes.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news and current affairs podcast, The Signal.
Protests have this way of infuriating people, and Extinction Rebellion has definitely made some enemies this week. But it turns out they're also pretty good at making friends. The movement has spread from the UK to hundreds of places around the world, including Australian cities, and it's still growing.
Every protest movement dreams of penetrating the mainstream, and Extinction Rebellion is giving it a go. So how is it trying to do that, and what's standing in its way?
That's The Signal. Find us every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.